Finance Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. We are going to start at the end of our agenda and open a work session on Senate Bill 580A. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, Senate Bill 580A expands the role of the Scientific and Technical Advisory Council, or STAC, to include, as resources allow, making recommendations to state agencies on matters relating to ocean and nearshore resources. Provide STAC membership guidelines, areas STAC can make recommendations, and methods to fill STAC membership vacancies. Declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There is neither a revenue impact nor a fiscal impact.
Okay. Colleagues, this is the bill we heard about in our last session relating to science and technical advisory. It is my opinion that this bill is ready to move on in the process. Is there any additional discussion on Senate Bill 580? Okay. Vice Chair Johnson.
Chair Bailey, I move Senate Bill 580A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves Senate Bill 580A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Ingram?
Aye.
Representative Gurdon?
Aye.
Representative Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Weiger?
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Excused.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. On its way to the floor. And you know, I think this would be a great one for Representative Boone to carry. So we'll check in with her. And we'll give this to Representative Boone. Close the work session on Senate Bill 580. Open a work session on Senate Bill 237A. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, Senate Bill 237A authorizes a public utility to issue a bill or refund to a customer if the customer was underbilled or overbilled for services provided within a one-year period, provided that that one-year period did not occur more than 2 years before the date on which the public utility identified the incorrect bill. Provides an exemption for public utilities in the case of customer fraud, tampering, diversion, theft, misinformation, or other dishonest or unlawful conduct. There is no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, we have our paperwork. Any discussion on this bill? Motion?
Chair Bailey, I move Senate Bill 237A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves Senate Bill 237A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Dimbrough?
Aye.
Representative Gruden?
Aye.
Representative
Vega
Peterson.
Aye.
Representative
Weiger.
Aye.
Representative
Whitsitt.
Aye, but I may be a no on the floor.
We'll record that as an aye.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Finn.
Excused.
Chair Bailey.
Aye. Motion carries. Volunteers to carry. Representative Weiger, you've done such a good job with so many bills out of this committee.
I probably shouldn't carry this one.
Representative Vega Peterson?
I will carry this one.
Thank you, Representative. Vega Peterson will carry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 237A. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 242. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, Senate Bill 242A modifies the definition of baseload energy as it relates to the Oregon Greenhouse Gas Emission Performance Standard, deletes provisions requiring the Public Utility Commission, or PUC, to review and modify a greenhouse gas emission standard, allows an electric company, electric service supplier, or customer of an electric company or electric service supplier to petition the PUC to study greenhouse gas emission standard to determine whether the standard is still necessary and whether it should be retained, repealed, or modified. It requires a report to the Legislative Assembly following the review within 12 months of receiving the petition for review.
And since there is nothing I like better than seeing a four-person panel awkwardly try to cram into a three-person dais, we'll call up Jeff Bissonette, Tashiana Wangler, Dan Bates, and Marion Haynes, please. Mr. Bissonette, I have you first on the list, but whoever would like to begin can begin.
Last chance.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers. This bill comes to you because back in 2009, we passed a bill establishing an emissions performance standard, basically saying that no new generating resource and no long-term resource could emit more than the most modern natural gas plant. It was a consensus policy, and we meant it to apply to both in-state and out-of-state resources, but the way we worded the bill back in 2009, we could not apply it to out-of-state resources, even though that's what everybody intended. And so after many years of trying, we decided that we needed a technical fix to the bill, and that is where 242 came from. Since 2009, there's been more discussion at the federal level on potential regulation in terms of emissions. There were some activities happening up in Washington State that people were watching that were of some concern to the utilities, and also the utilities were had some particularly concerns about some changeovers they were making in some of their existing coal plants, and you'll hear more about that in just a minute. But we were able basically to come up with solutions to all of those concerns, and we bring before you a consensus bill that is agreed to by the public interest groups represented here by myself and Mr. Bates to my left, and also the utilities. I'll stop there and let Ms. Wengler go through just the pieces of the bill, and then we'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Tashiana Wengler. I'm the Government Affairs Manager for PacifiCorp. We serve approximately 1.7 million people across the western U.S., and in Oregon we have about 550,000 customers. We support 242A, and just a few of the provisions that we think are important to bring to your attention. For utilities, it provides clarity and certainty around new investments that we can make in electric generation facilities. It makes it clear that we may invest in natural gas plants. It exempts coal plants that have been converted to natural gas. So this ensures that if we find it to be economically feasible to make that conversion and good for our customers, we're able to do that. It also modifies how the standard will be reviewed. It allows the Public Utility Commission to review the standard if federal and state law has changed to establish carbon regulation, and so it enables them to take a look at it and see at that time if it should be modified. So those are the primary provisions, and I'd be happy to take any questions you have.
Thank you. Ms. Haynes.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Marion Haynes, and I represent Portland General Electric. I would echo a lot of the comments of my colleagues up here. I guess the one thing that I would add that the bill additionally does is removes the ability to ratchet down the standard that was set in statute originally. And as Jeff has noted, the original deal was to have this apply to both in-state and out-of-state resources. It was also to really get at coal plants and coal facilities. So keeping that standard set where it is now ensures that there isn't a process that could impact utilities, gas facilities right now. So with that, we also support Senate Bill 242. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Bates.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, Dan Bates with Renewable Northwest Project. Echo the comments today. We are supportive of 242A. Believe that as it's been carefully crafted and come to you today, that it represents the deal that was struck in 2009 with the changes that were suggested today, and glad that it enjoys the support.
I just submit to Representative Johnson that I hope he brought his camera for another kumbaya picture.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of curious why we'd want to do this to ourselves, because if we can buy coal power cheaper from somebody else that has a coal-fired power plant than we could natural gas or one of the other utilities, why would we not buy that power to save the ratepayers money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, the answer to your question is sort of on two levels. One is that under the standard, you can buy coal power with a 5-year or less contract, and so you can take advantage of if there's a short-term ability to do that. But in the long term, and that's really where this bill is focused, I think most folks believe, that no matter what you think about global warming, that at some point you're going to have some sort of regulation on greenhouse gas emissions, and it doesn't take very much regulation to make coal very expensive. And so what we're trying to avoid is investing now in a resource that could be cheap today, but in 5, 10, 15 years, and we're talking about a resource that if we build it would have a 40 or 50 year lifespan, could become very expensive. And if that happens, halfway through its life, and we have to either significantly curtail that resource or it's more economic to shut it down, then the ratepayers lose that investment and they have to invest in additional resources to meet that load that has become, or to meet that resource that has become too expensive to operate. So this is really trying to have some near-term flexibility through the 5-year contract provision, but acknowledging that we want to be careful of the investments we're making today and that ratepayers don't get stuck sort of paying twice for a resource on down the line again in 10, 15, 20 years.
Representative Widener, I would also note that natural gas is very inexpensive right now, and we see that for the foreseeable future. So being able to take advantage of short-term opportunities where there may be some, nothing in this also impacts existing facilities that utilities have, so you're not seeing increased costs on facilities that are already part of our portfolio.
Additional questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the 5-year reason for why not 10 years, why not 2 years, why the 5 years? It's in the existing statute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I think that as with many things in statute, that seemed like a good number that worked for everybody.
Chair Bailey, Representative Bentz, I would also say that I believe when Oregon was passing their emissions performance standard, they were looking at existing law in California and Washington and trying to ensure consistency across the states. And so that may be one reason why five years or more was chosen.
But to be clear, that is in the existing statute from the policy decision that was made in a previous session. Is that correct? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been approached, I think others have also, by another out-of-state generator that's apparently being treated differently than in-state generators that have coal. I don't understand the difference or how this bill manages that difference. Could you explain it? Do you want me to be clearer?
Perhaps be more specific in your question.
Okay. So my understanding is that we have at least three organizations that are in-state utilities that have coal-generated power that still comes into Oregon, and that this bill has no impact on those arrangements. And yet there is a operation in Washington that would like to import coal-generated electricity and apparently can't. I'm sure we're going to hear from them, so we'll get more clarity on that soon. But why should there be a difference, if there is one, between those utilities in Oregon and this operation outside? What's the good, solid reason for that difference?
Chair Bailey, Representative Betts, I think this law is intended to apply to Oregon utilities and the Oregon consumers that those utilities serve. So with the 5-year requirement, that could still provide a short-term ability for an Oregon utility to purchase coal fueled electric generation from that other party, but I think it's probably a question that they're best left to answer.
And Before we get into additional follow-ups, I would note that we're asking the panel to respond to an argument that has not yet been made in front of this committee. So perhaps we can, Representative.
Sure. I'm tempted to ask your point, but your point must be that we're going to hear this argument as opposed to my anticipating it. But if I may, these folks are well suited to answer since they have coal generating facilities outside the state, and those facilities will still be generating carbon. And that's one of the purposes of this bill. We need to understand that.
If you're asking about their facilities, Representative, then I, by all means, please proceed.
Thank you.
If you're asking about a specific instance of an advocate bringing an issue before the committee that has not yet been brought before the committee, I would think it would be appropriate to wait to hear about the specific case that's being offered before asking about a hypothetical.
Mr. Chair, you're the chair. And I think I should then direct my question to these folks about their out-of-state coal-generating facilities, and I will do so, with your permission.
Please.
So, as I need to know how much out-of-state coal generation there is that we will continue to utilize under this agreement. You can give me some very general numbers.
Chair Bailey, Representative, I'd have to get back to you on the number. We do have an interest in Colstrip, which is a facility in Montana, and I don't have at my fingertips the number of megawatts that we bring into our system from that facility, but I could follow up with you on that.
Chair Bailey, Representative Bentz, Pacific Core's portfolio of owned resources is approximately 10,000 megawatts of capacity. Of that, I believe, and I'd have to get back to you to ensure that I'm entirely accurate, I believe we're about 60% coal at this time, and none of those coal facilities are in Oregon.
Thank you.
So just to add from the consumer point of view, Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, we're talking about owned facilities by our utilities, in this case PGE and PacifiCorp, and as Ms. Haynes said, if they have a need to, acquire a 5-year or less contract, they can do that from anybody. But what this saying that somebody else's, non-owned resource is being treated differently than anybody else's, I would disagree with that statement. I think that we are talking about the utility's owned resources and then everything else. And I think that, the situation that you're talking about follows in the everything else category, and they're being treated exactly the same as everything else.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for consideration.
Absolutely. Additional questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for this panel. Call forward Matt Stuervall, please.
I'm sure it is. Go into your lawyer.
Speak the difference.
I feel so lonely. Good afternoon, Chairman Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Matt Sterwalt. I work with Strategies 360. My client in this matter is a company called TransAlta. TransAlta is a Canadian-owned company. It is Canada's largest renewable energy generator. Its portfolio is approximately a third renewables, a third natural gas, and a third coal-fired resources. Its closest resources to the state of Oregon are some geothermal projects being developed in Southern California, a very small hydro project in Washington, and a reasonably large coal-fired facility in Centralia, Washington, of about 1,340 megawatts. For the committee's reference, because I imagine you're much more familiar with the in-state facilities, the Centralia facility is approximately twice the size of the Boardman facility that you guys might know more about. The company is a direct contributor to the Oregon economy. There are approximately 40 Oregon companies that provide service to the facility in various forms. It's a very specialized operation, and some of those skills and some of those resources are here in Oregon. About $100 million a year flows back into Oregon from the facility for that exchange of goods and services. All of the fly ash, which is a byproduct of power production, goes into cement, concrete, and asphalt production, which basically paves roads in Oregon, just so that you have some context of the value of the facility from an economic perspective. It's also a regional resource, right? You all understand that the power markets and the grid do not stop at the Columbia River. We're interconnected, for better or for worse. The facility is about 40-some-odd years old and is the largest resource west of the Cascades. So much of the transmission infrastructure that we have today was designed around the facility. So there is a reliability benefit and a network stability benefit that the facility provides. There have been studies by folks like Columbia Grid and the Power Council, which I can provide to staff and to the members if they're interested in those issues. As you heard from the last panel, actually, let me do one more thing. The facility is closing. In 2011, the owners reached an agreement with the local environmental community in Washington State, the labor folks in Washington State, the governor's office, and had that agreement codified by the legislature. It closes the facility half in 2020, the other half in 2025. The company pays out of its own pocket $55 million in transition funds. $20 million of that is for local economic development to sort of help the community in which the company is located make a transition from having a large employer to not having a large employer. There's $10 million for local energy efficiency and $25 million for a regional clean technology fund. Those monies have not been spent yet. The money is being paid into the fund. So decisions about where those kinds of investments are going to be made have not been made yet. In exchange for doing that, and for installing state-of-the-art pollution control on the facility, which has been done, the company got long-term markets in Washington State, that 5 years or longer arbitrary timeline that is in place in all three of the West Coast states, was close to Centralia for the same reasons that you're contemplating here. It is now open to the company until the facility closes. We could currently sell to willing buyers in Oregon if the current version of 242 passes, that market will be close to us. I understand, and in fact, the company is completely fine with the underlying policy rationale of where Oregon seems to be headed on its resources, which is to prevent, as Mr. Bissonnette said, those companies from making new long-term commitments to high carbon intensity resources. I would submit that you've already achieved that with this facility. This facility is going to close. Its air permits require it, state law requires it, it has a separate and binding enforceable contract with the state of Washington to do it. It's going away. You know, the policy objective has been met. With that in mind, the company would very much appreciate the committee's consideration of an amendment to recognize that commitment, to allow it to continue to have the opportunity, not the guarantee, but the opportunity to find a willing buyer in Oregon. If such a buyer steps forward before the facility closes. I'm happy to talk through what an amendment might look like or answer questions from the committee about the justification for that kind of consideration. Thank you very much for the time this afternoon.
Thank you. Questions for this witness? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What in this contract, we just heard that you could sell on a five-year contract into Oregon, is that incorrect?
In current law, we could sell 5 years or longer. If this bill passes, we would be precluded from accessing those markets. We would be forced into selling in the short-term market. And I'll answer, maybe if I can anticipate, a question that seems to have flown from the last panel, why that's important, why 5 years it provides some value that 4 years doesn't provide. TransAlta is different than your local utilities. It doesn't have retail customers. It's a wholesale merchant company. That means it competes for customers in the open market in a very competitive market. It has both variable costs of doing business and variable revenues from competing in that wholesale market. As any business would probably tell you, taking some of the risk out of the business is very important. right? And particularly with this short horizon that they've imposed on themselves, this 2020 and 2025 horizon, they're looking for the chance to make sure that they can have a shot at recovering their investment in the facility. Having the ability to do long-term contracts takes that risk out and gives them the opportunity to get that capital back out of the facility before it closes.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much power historically have you sold into Oregon? And if you got your amendment, would you anticipate selling? And please state it in megawatts.
Okay. Historically, there have been a number of short-term agreements where power actually flows from the facility to buyers in Oregon. I can get a specific number for that. I don't have that off the top of my head. There haven't been long-term contracts with Oregon utilities in quite some time. The facility used to be owned by some of the people that you saw and some of the people that are elsewhere. So there's, you know, if you go back to the genesis of the facility, quite a lot. What the company is looking for is a very small amount, something on the order of 100 megawatts, 120 megawatts of new sales to help trigger the flow of that $55 million investment fund.
One question?
Please.
The amount of carbon, the differential between natural gas on the one hand and that which you sell on the other is about double. Is that correct?
Correct.
So for the 100 megawatts you're suggesting, do you have an idea, or could you get us the amount of carbon that's created in excess of that which would be created if we were burning natural gas for that 100 megawatts?
Yes. And if I wasn't a poli-sci major, I could do the math for you here. But I think I would give you poli-sci math, and I'd rather actually go get someone to give you that fact.
Just a statement, Mr. Chair. The 100 megawatts is per year. What's 100 megawatts?
Yeah. So you should think about it as a small slice of supply that would go over the course of a year for some period of time. Obviously, they're looking for a contract that extends 5 years or greater. Otherwise, I wouldn't be seeking the amendment. But that would go away when the facility goes away. So that answer your question?
It does. Mr. Chair, I did have one more, please, with your indulgence. You talked about a $25 million fund that you want to use for the development of clean energy, and that fund could be available for grants to colleges in Oregon, such as PSU or OSU. And the concept, of course, is to do things that would offset whatever carbon you might create by virtue of using coal instead of natural gas. Am I understanding that correctly?
You are understanding that correctly. There is this pool of money that would be available. The distribution of the money has not, as I said before, has not been determined. They are looking for the very best ideas in new technology, whether those ideas are at Portland State or Oregon State or anywhere else. And they're looking for impactful investments, so, you know, in chunks rather than in dribbles, right? So things that would move the needle on clean technology, whether it's carbon reduction technology or new clean generation technology or, you know, ancillary technologies. I would think of things like electric vehicles as being sort of in the ancillary technology bucket. But yes, you got the concept exactly correct.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think something, I'm going to kind of give you a question here that may help the committee understand this. Primarily, you would go out to bid to like a local city-owned utility, like I have the city of McMinnville. They buy power from Bonneville, or they might buy it from you, depending upon who comes in with the less price, and they would do a contract for a period of 10 years. That they would have a set price over that 10 years from your company. Is that correct?
Yeah, Representative, you've essentially got that correct. My client competes for opportunities to sell to utilities such as your local utility, and they have to compete on price. They also compete on other things. There, you will find utilities that want to diversify their portfolio so that they're not risking everything on the fluctuations of natural gas. or are they not risking everything on the fluctuations of the hydro system managed by Bonneville? But yeah, it's a competitive process. They go against whoever else has supply and hope to find a willing buyer.
Follow up. You may not know the answer to this, but I do just because I hear it all the time in my district. But usually, what would the power rates or the cost for power from a local city-owned utility versus a person who lived outside and bought from PGE their power?
So, Representative, I have to admit that Oregon is not my home state. I know the Washington state retail rates pretty well, but I don't know your own. Ours generally in Washington, we have a much higher preponderance of public power. They get some resources from Bonneville that are relatively inexpensive, so they tend to be relatively inexpensive. That changes for very rural utilities, where a large part of the cost is in the transmission, is in the poles and wires, and those utilities tend to have very challenging retail rates for their customers. It may be different here.
Just for the record, McMinnville is about 30% less than the other communities around us, so it's a huge savings that they have that helps out the people who live in the city of McMinnville tremendously.
Any other questions for this witness? Representative Reardon.
I'm just curious as the duration of a typical contract that they might have. We talked about short-term, long-term. Is there a typical?
Representative, I think there are some standards, right? There are hour ahead, day ahead, month ahead, year ahead, 5-year blocks, and then there are some, what would you rightly call them? You know, the Baskin-Robbins flavors, right? You can, between a willing buyer and a willing seller, you can set up almost anything. The most recent transaction I'm aware of between my client and a willing buyer in Washington State starts in 2014, increases in volume until 2020, decreases in volume again until 2025, so it's an 11-year contract. Does that help?
So no real standard.
Yeah.
Representative, what's it?
Do you know what was the initial investment of your coal-fired plant when it was built? Or what you paid for it?
Representative, let me answer that in two ways, neither of which will be particularly satisfying. So the plant was originally built as a partnership of 8 regional utilities in 1972, 1973, 1974, and I have no idea what the original capital costs are. My client bought the facility in 1999 and 2000, and I was actually a witness for the ratepayers. I had the corresponding job of Mr. Bissonnette in Washington State. And so I know exactly what they paid for it, but I'm under oath from a confidentiality proceeding to not disclose the number. I can tell you what they've invested in the facility since then for pollution control and those kinds of things, but this is a very big capital intensive thing, and you should think in the order of lots and lots of zeros.
May I? May I ask, what is the cost of conversion now?
So that's a great question, too. The legislation governing the transition in Washington contemplates that they will go away and allows them to expedite permitting on a new natural gas facility at the same location. And the theory was there is value to the region in not having to move the poles and wires around. So we wanted to make sure that if they wanted to put something there, they had a chance to do that. Depending on the size of the facility, right, and these do come in different sizes, new natural gas plants tend to be much less capital intensive than a coal plant, on, you know, order of magnitude less, a couple $100 million maybe for a relatively small one. I can get you, or perhaps one of your utilities that actually buys and operates these things might be a better source of what a recent one looks like.
One more.
So Would you characterize this as the ratepayers paying for both of these plants?
Representative, I would actually not. There are no ratepayers attached to this facility. It's a wholesale facility. It sells to willing buyers. If there are customers, there are customers. If there are not, they get no money.
Ultimately, someone pays for these plants.
Yes.
Who pays for these plants, ultimately?
Ultimately, whoever funds the local utility pays the price of this if it goes into rates, right? So if there was a Washington buyer that had local ratepayers, and if the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission allowed the cost of the contract into rates, then yes, just like every other resource, it would be borne by local ratepayers.
Thank you.
You bet. Senator Reardon?
Just one last question. Could you just make this as simple as possible and answer one question? What's in it for Oregon?
I would point to three things. Number one, as I mentioned, the ongoing economic return from the operation of the plant, the 40 vendors and the $100 million a year of money that flows back out of Centralia for Oregon businesses. Number two, to the extent that an actual contract were to be signed and it had economic benefits for ratepayers, it was cheaper or diversified risk or did both, right? There are benefits to Oregonians who would get those from having a contract. Number three, as I mentioned before, the grid is a regional resource, right? And the investments for managing the transmission system are largely socialized across the region, and Oregon pays their fair share of those investments. The study that looked at what the cost of replacing the resource at Centralia would be were it to go away was an April 2011 Columbia Grid study. The replacement costs are on the hundreds of millions of dollars, and who pays for them depends on what investments are specifically made to replace the resource. Right? So if, to the extent you are avoiding those investments for a long time, that's a good benefit for you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson.
You mentioned some amendments that are either in the thought process or in some stage of implementation. Are you working on those, or are you planning to
go
through? And could you maybe just share specifically what they might entail?
Yes. I have approached a couple of members of the committee about their willingness to entertain the introduction of an amendment, and so you have to forgive my lack of local course knowledge. I'm learning my way as I go about that process. The gist of the amendment would be there are sections in 242, I believe it's the, let me get the bill out, I'll tell you. In section one, in three, little a, big C, there's a possibility to introduce language that says something to the effect of, so these are resources that do not have to comply with the standard, right? This is a list of resources that get out of the standard. So it would be an amendment that said a resource that has made a legally enforceable binding commitment to close down by a date certain so that you're not frustrating the policy goal, right, of making sure there are no new long-term investments, right? You could do the same thing with the same effect down in 10B, which is another list of investments that don't trigger the standard, right? Your counsel is probably much more qualified than I to opine on the best construction of something like that. But that's the gist of the idea.
Thank you.
Okay. Any no further questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much for your time.
We'll call up Alana Guinea, please.
Thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ilana Guinea with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I am here today on behalf of our affiliate union, IBEW Local 25. They unfortunately were not able to make it. Local 25 has members who work at the TransAlta plant in Centralia. They have members who work at energy facilities across Oregon and generally are supportive of the concept in House Bill 242. They are very concerned that the effect that this bill would have on the TransAlta plant is that their jobs would end sooner. They are worried that this could lead to layoffs there. While most of their members who work at that plant live in Washington, they do have members who work there who live in Oregon. They have periodically, throughout the time that they've represented workers at that plant, had members who live in Oregon. While we understand and while they understand that greening our economy and our energy sources is important and that sometimes that does lead to job disruptions, we've worked with the legislature here to try to minimize those job disruptions and create ways to retrain those workers and get them to other jobs. Their workers at Centralia have been planning for a 2020 or 2025 layoff. They've planned their next steps for their families around that, and they are concerned that if more of those layoffs were to come sooner, it would cause further disruptions. I just wanted to add that to the record as you consider what to do with amendments that might be brought in this bill moving forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. President Whitsitt?
I was wondering if you could give an estimate of how many AFL-CIO members work in coal-fired plants across the West whose electricity comes into Oregon.
I am happy, Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, to send you the answer to that question. I do not have it off the top of my head.
Could you do that for all of the committee? That'd be great. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative Weiner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hopefully you can answer this one, Alana. You know how much the average wage is for your workers in these power plants?
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, I don't know what the average wage is at TransAlta. Generally, members who work in that union make, you know, it varies depending on the state, and they do have members in a tri-state area, but 2 to 3 times minimum wage, sometimes upwards of there, depending on the job.
Would it be safe to say in excess of $30 an hour?
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, I believe that in these jobs, their average member makes more around the lines of $20 to $25 an hour, but folks who have been in these positions for a while probably do make upwards of $30 an hour.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One more.
I just wondered, is the person still here from TransAlta? Because I had some numbers in my office that suggested 270 people with salaries of $88,000 a year.
And I want to be clear here, and you're welcome to come up and answer that. I want to be clear on the terms of the debate here that we are not rehashing the decision that Washington has made on this coal plant, but we are happy to discuss items that are germane to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Matt Sturwalt on behalf of TransAlta. To answer the employment and wage questions, the numbers that Representative Whitsitt have are accurate. It is about 280 current employees. The average wage is just north of $88,000 a year. The facility is located in Lewis County, Washington, where the average wage is approximately $30,000, maybe $31,000 a year. And if I might, to make sure that we're equally clear, we're not asking to rehash the decision that we made on the facility either. We are asking for your consideration to continue to have access to the Oregon market to help with that transition.
Representative Denbrough?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that information. And I just want to say that you've once again confirmed my belief that the state needs to be investing in career technical education and apprenticeship. Thank you.
You're welcome, sir.
On that note, thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Yes. Thank you.
Anybody else who wish to testify on Senate Bill 242A? Seeing none, close public hearing on Senate Bill 242A. Anything else for the good of the committee? The committee is adjourned.
Well.